Just to present ourselves briefly, we're Phil and Mavis Anderson. Mavis is a staff person of the Augsburg College Center for Global Education, which does many travel seminars throughout the world, but principally to Central America with its proximity to the United States, with the idea of using these experiences, somewhat hands-on, to become familiar with issues and our connections as United States people to other parts of the world. My name is Phil Anderson. Most recently, I have been the Lutheran World Federation representative of the Department of World Service in Central America, and both of us have been living in El Salvador. The Lutheran World Federation Department of World Service is a development and relief agency, and in that way we get involved primarily in areas where there have been disasters, either natural disasters, earthquakes, floods, and the like, or wars. And increasingly, we're involved with refugees and displaced people throughout the world. And we're like many other church-related organizations. You can think of Catholic Relief Service, though that's a U.S.-based agency of the U.S. Catholic Conference and the bishops. The Lutheran World Federation, based in Geneva, represents 104 member churches from around the world and nearly 60 million Lutherans. All of us as church agencies are involved in the issues, some of which we'll be dealing with today. How to bring about some development or at least relief to the tragic consequences faced by so many people throughout the world. Though we'll be talking about Central America, I think that it would be very fair and good to understand that many of the issues that deal with the environment are typical of many, many other areas around the world, in Africa and Asia and all of Latin America, and perhaps in some other areas, including the United States. The theme of Holden Village this year, On Earth as in Heaven, is very appropriate sort of introductory title to what we're talking about, the value that we place on the earth, just as we value the will of God as it comes in the vision of creation, and as we think that God has a plan for earth creation, for humanity. So we'll recall that what we have is a broken world, not only in our own human sinfulness, but in the way in which we have destroyed so much of the earth's environment. And indeed, the world is moaning in travail for reconciliation with God. And of course, we as human beings, caretakers in this world, are called to be a part of that integrity of creation. In my work in El Salvador, particularly in the last 2-3 years, I would say, I've become increasingly aware of and anxious about the environment and the plight that particularly the war has on dealing with environmental impact and destruction. Probably equal to the tragedy of the loss of human life is the destruction of the environment, and they're very intimately linked. We cannot solve one without solving the other, though at sometimes I'm even more hopeful about solving issues such as war and peace than of the environmental question. And it's if we can achieve peace, let's say, in El Salvador, ceasefire, as they are projecting by September of this year, that's the hope, that's the design, we will have on our hands for, in fact, generations to come. Important questions dealing with the environment, to recuperate an environment which has been destroyed. And we'll get into some of those issues. One difficulty, I would say, just like in the United States, is within Central America and perhaps other parts of the world, is a consciousness about environmental issues. It's still difficult for many of us in the United States to understand the tremendous questions involved of being environmentally responsible. And though perhaps there are many people who have a consciousness about the environment in El Salvador, Central America, other parts of the world, there are such tremendously strong political and social and economic forces at play that the environment is left to further deteriorate. We might keep in mind also that the history of Latin America, as perhaps the history of other parts of the world, Africa, perhaps Asia, is really the history of the exploitation of both the human and the natural resources, both renewable resources as well as non-renewable resources, many of the mineral wealth. And so what we see now in the last few decades in Central America is the continuation of an attitude, of a way of viewing these lands, these people. And then again, there's a connectedness. And it's a history whose time has got to come to an end. That is the exploitation both of the land and of the human resources for the benefit of those who in one way or another colonize that land. We talked today about a neo-colonialism, that is a new colonialism. We're no longer, it's not Spanish colonies within Latin America or Portuguese colonies or French or British, yet there is a neo-colonialism, that is the colonialism of our economic systems worldwide. With that brief introduction, Mavis is going to give a little bit more background on the Central America reality.
We thought that what we do today is use El Salvador as something of a case study, because a lot of the issues that are very upfront in El Salvador in terms of the environment pertain, as Phil said, to many places around the world, certainly to the other Latin American countries, specifically the countries in Central America that have been and still are involved in war also. But really to any nation with highly unequal distribution of resources, the environment quickly becomes a very poignant issue. El Salvador's environment is probably the most degraded environment in Latin America, according to a group called EPICA, which is an environmental group out of San Francisco that deals with environmental issues in Central America. Just taking a little bit of a look at the history of the environmental destruction in El Salvador, up until this day, there has been no systematic effort to preserve woodlands, to prevent contamination of waterways, to practice soil conservation, to use, in moderate senses, pesticides or herbicides. There's just been no attention paid to it at all in any practical way. Before the conquest in the 1500s by the Spaniards, the method of cultivation of the land that was used was slash and burn, which means that the indigenous population would take a tract of land, they'd burn it off to clear it, they would cultivate the land, use it for growing their crops for a few years, not very many, but for a few, until the fertility of the soil began to reduce. Then they'd move on to another plot of land, they'd slash and burn that piece of land. And this actually worked pretty well for them because there was not so much pressure on the land in terms of population. There was an abundance of land and there was a small number of people, so that as they moved from plot to plot, they gave time for that first plot that they had had exhausted to recover. That can't be done today. It's not a viable method to cultivate the land. When the Spaniards came in the 1500s, they exploited huge tracts of land. They brought in cattle and began to clear land, cleared large tracts of forest for cattle grazing. And they would more or less enslave the indigenous population and require them to cut down the forest, turn the forest land into pastures. They introduced the plow, which brought with it its own environmental destruction as it caused more and more erosion. They introduced a crop called indigo, which, especially in the northern part of El Salvador, caused the destruction of large tracts of forest. And indigo is a plant that robs the soil very quickly of its nutrients. And if you go up to Chalatenango yet today, you can see the effects of this crop, which has not been cultivated in El Salvador now for over 100 years. But the results of that particular crop being grown there are still seen in the severe soil erosion and in the barrenness of the land in that part of the country. One of the things that we've found historically in El Salvador is that the ecological problems are intrinsically tied to the social problems in the country. And you can see this in land use patterns. As the Spaniards came in and as cash crops were introduced into the country, coffee, cotton, and sugar, the indigenous population, which had been cultivating the flat areas of the country, were forced off of those lands up onto the slopes of the volcanoes, up onto the slopes of the hills. And they were then forced to grow their crops for domestic consumption on marginal lands that really are inappropriate for anything but forests. But the forests then became cleared away. And the rural population was denied access to the flatlands. This was especially seen in the cultivation of coffee also. The effect of this clearly has been to reduce the topsoil in the country substantially, and it has denuded the hills of their forests. The future of El Salvador is tied to the land. It's an economic, or it's an agricultural economy, and probably will remain so. It has very few minerals. It has a very undeveloped manufacturing sector. And so the future of the country is tied to the land, which makes the environment an even more important thing for them to pay attention to. The Indians today, or the indigenous population, continue to use slash and burn. They burn their crops to prepare for the next year's crop. And this is not viable for them now because of the intense pressure on the land. You can't use a plot of land and next year move on to another plot, because literally every inch of land in El Salvador is in use. It's a very tense or intensely populated country. The normal rate of soil erosion, I learned, is less than 1 inch topsoil loss is less than 1 inch per 100 years. However, in El Salvador right now, the soil is being lost at the rate of 1.5 inches per year, which is just an incredible statistic in my mind. You know, normally in fields that we would see 100 years to lose 1 inch of soil. And yet in El Salvador, an inch and a half per year. The Organization of American States estimated in 1974 that 77% of the countryside was badly eroded partly due to these methods of cultivation. And in 1989, the statistic rose to 83%. Another issue in the environment is deforestation, beyond just the cultivation. Only 6% of the original vegetation in El Salvador remains. The rest of it has been just removed. This causes an incredible runoff of the rains. El Salvador has a dry season and a wet season. The dry season, literally, there's no rain. In the wet season, there can be very, very heavy rains. And what happens is that the heavy rains just wash right off the hillsides. The river bottoms, which have become parched and dry during the dry season, cannot soak up all of the water, which washes down, and so it causes great floods. In 1988, there were some very serious floodings where some 20,000 people lost their homes in the floodings, and 20,000 animals were killed. Crops were destroyed. just whole communities of people were washed away. And this water, which had there been vegetation on the hillsides, would have sunk into the soil and reached the water table, went into the rivers and then just out to sea, and it literally was lost to the population for use. Water contamination is also an issue. There is a lack of treatment of both human and industrial waste. Sewage is just dumped completely raw into the waterways. There's an uncontrolled use of chemicals in the form of fertilizers and pesticides. Agro-industrial waste from the coffee and sugarcane also are dumped into the waterways. Cotton has been an especial ecological nightmare for the country because it requires the use of a lot of pesticides. And as resistant strains of pests have developed, more lethal brands of pesticides are used in larger dosages. And it has been the crop that probably has caused the most problem in terms of the pesticides. Up until this time, we haven't seen in El Salvador any political will to address these problems. Part of this, it comes, I think, from the unquestioned bias of the landed wealthy who want to use this land for export crops. And the government then never takes a serious look at the disastrous consequences of forcing the peasants off of these lands and up into the hillsides and forcing them to cultivate for their own sustenance lands that really are not suitable to grow crops. One of the effects that you see in a country like this where the people do not have resources is that their children become their only resource. And so you see in El Salvador a population that has a high population growth, and families, peasant families in the countryside, have a lot of children. These are their resources. And as the population grows, there's more and more demand upon the land to produce more and more food, and less ability of the land to be able to do that. All of that is bad enough. It's a pretty bleak picture without taking into account at all the war. But when you add that to the picture, it becomes even bleaker. One of the policies that the United States practiced in Vietnam was the scorched earth policy, where the effort was to separate the people and the guerrillas, the fighters, from the land. And during that time in Vietnam, between 1963 and 1968, we, the U.S. Army, by using napalm, just denuded acres and acres and acres of Vietnam. We dropped some 100,000 tons of napalm on Vietnam. We chemically destroyed rice fields to force the population into strategic hamlets where we could control them, keep them away from the guerrilla. And also, we destroyed the rice fields to deprive the guerrilla of food. This scorched earth policy targets civilian populations. It targets vegetation, natural vegetation, in addition to targeting guerrillas. Well, some of these same methods, or many of these same methods, have been taught by us to the Salvadorans, and so these are used in their guerrilla warfare, their counterinsurgency war also. The accusation is made that defoliants are used and that bombs are dropped that burn huge football field areas of land with a single bomb. Bombs from 100 to 750 pounds are dropped. There are craters left in the countryside that are 15 feet deep. In addition to the aerial bombardments, the army comes in, and in order to flush out the guerrilla, they set fires, they burn homes, they burn crops, they burn forests, they burn undergrowth. This forces the civilian population to flee the land and then leaves it more open for the army to come in and search for the guerrilla. Artillery in their ground searches starts underbrush fires, which further denudes the land. The war also affects the water supply. The military practice of bombing and burning the mountainsides and the volcanoes and the cloud forest jeopardizes the future water supply because it's well established that there's a relationship between the existence of cloud forests or forests
and the amount of rainfall that that falls on the land. So the water table is reducing substantially. Another effect, which at least indirectly is due to the war, is that there is in El Salvador almost uncontrolled urbanization right now. People flee the countryside and have over the past 10 years because of the pressure of the war, because of the destroying of their homes and their crops. And they either flee in large numbers to other countries, or even more so, they flee into the cities in their own country. And the pressure that that's put upon the public services in the cities is just, it's to the breaking point in terms of water, in terms of electricity, in terms of sanitation. When we were in El Salvador, our home was in an area of the city that had electricity off and on, though that was a more irregular thing. But in terms of water, we'd have water in our home from about 5 in the morning until noon. And the rest of the day, the water was just turned off because there was an insufficient supply. People come into the cities and they live in subhuman conditions. They build little shacks on the ravines and the gullies, which sort of crisscross the city of San Salvador. They have only 18% of these people who live in the slums of San Salvador have access to safe drinking water, just 18%. 6% of them have primary schools. None of them have adequate garbage pickup, have adequate health centers. So the pressures that puts on the cities is just amazing. And also when people come into the cities, they'll find any little plot that they can to build on, and they'll clear it. So whatever vegetation there may have been in the cities is cleared away also. And they also use wood for their fuel. So they cut down trees or use the underbrush to fuel their fires to cook their food. What happens then is on these hillsides that they clear, the hillsides become unsafe. During the rains, there are mudslides and whole communities just wash down into the ravines. The longer that the war continues, the greater the environmental destruction is going to be, and the more costly the reconstruction, if indeed it's going to be possible to do that. As I said, there has been no systematic effort on the part of the government to do anything about this. There have been some environmental groups that have begun to try to raise people's consciousness about the environment, though really that the consciousness of the population in general is so untuned to the environment. Their consciousness is set on survival, finding enough food to put on their tables per day so that they can live, and on surviving the war. And the environment is just not an issue for them. Also, the military and the wealthy landowners have no motivation whatsoever to stop their practices, economically or militarily. On paper, if you read some of the decrees by the Salvadoran government, it doesn't sound too bad. They've created about 6 different agencies that are supposed to look at natural resources and conservation. In fact, the Ministry of Agriculture was given the responsibility for conservation way back in 1911. But these agencies are understaffed, they're underfunded, they have no political clout whatsoever, and so nothing gets done. Just one small example, there's one of the agencies that's called the Natural Environmental Committee. It was created in 1974, and to this day it has yet to call its first meeting. Not much happens. And as I said, the awareness among the population in general is just not there. Especially when I was first there, and I must admit I kind of became acclimated to this, but you're driving in a car with Salvadorans, and maybe this is more, not so much environmental as it is aesthetic, but you drive along and people just use the roadsides as garbage dumps. You have a box of rolls in the car and you finish eating your snack and the box is thrown out the window. You drink a glass of, or a plastic bag of orange juice or of Coca-Cola, the plastic bag is tossed out the window. Phil's point was often, though, all right, so they don't toss it out the window. That kind of disperses it among the countryside. If you put it in a garbage bin, one, there aren't any, and two, if there were, they would, you know, just end up heaped somewhere anyway. So it's just, public services are an incredible problem. But actually, toward the end of my time there, I found myself doing the same thing, tossing the bags out the window.
They do that in Minnesota, too.
Yeah, true, true. No, nothing like this, nothing like this. It's sobering to think, and I want to echo what Phil said, it's sobering to think that the destruction to the environment in El Salvador may be more of a serious future problem than the economic and the infrastructural damage that the war has done. It just it seems to me to be a very, very bleak picture, and I think it's going to be the next major, or is already, a major challenge that El Salvador and all of Central America are going to have to face.
Good. I've just put up a number of the things that have been touched on the board. They're just kind of snapshots of the enormity of the problem. One thing we may say about the region of El Salvador, this map isn't very large. There are some very natural characteristics of the region that also make it more vulnerable. One is it's volcanic in much of the area, and also earthquakes. And so those two natural features, as well as the possibility for hurricanes off the Caribbean coast, which most dramatically a couple of years ago hit the east coast of Nicaragua at Bluefields and destroyed the town of Bluefields and up the river, and this entire area was damaged with all of its forest, all the trees were knocked down. Tremendous damage. So there were incidents like in August of 88, very heavy rainfall to be sure, but given the deforestation over time, no longer any real natural forest there, we went into the area a few days after the floods. And mindful, you're in the middle of a war at any rate. It's hard to move around the country. And at that time, the army declared an emergency to essentially control regions. So it takes some effort, getting up the gumption to go out there and try to move around. It was just as if someone had taken giant hands with their fingernails and clawed into the hills. And just stripped them in valleys down to the rivers, and then clogged up the rivers, and as Mavis said, then washed away a number of small communities, all of which wouldn't necessarily take place had that vegetation been there. The other factor being that people are now living in vulnerable areas that they wouldn't normally have to live in, along those rivers and streams and below those mountains, which may be susceptible to landslides like that. So it is a vulnerable region of the world, like so many. One interesting phenomenon also in Bangladesh, you remember now 2 years ago, this summer, there was an enormous flood. About one third, I think maybe one half of the nation was underwater. At some points, 15 to 30 feet underwater. There was a joke that we have a major program in Bangladesh of the Lutheran World Federation that the president of Bangladesh declared himself the admiral. The problem is really not one of Bangladesh. It doesn't originate there. The problem originates in the neighboring country of Nepal, where they have also deforested the mountains. And so what you have is the erosion, the flooding, flash flooding nearly, coming down into the valleys and the rivers. These things compound themselves year after year after year. And it takes, of course, time to recover. Non-governmental organizations have begun to work at these ecological problems, though again, as Mavis said, we're caught up often in the immediacy of how to survive from day to day. For the you might say, well, why don't the people move, say, into more organic farming, to move away from the use of agriculture inputs like fertilizers and pesticides? But I don't know if some of you who maybe come from the land, from farming, know that it's not easy to move from chemically dependent to modern techniques of agriculture, in a sense, to organic farming. There's a huge risk and a number of years it takes to make that transition. And a farmer who, at any rate, has his family's life in the balance on what can be produced on the land, cannot risk that transition. We did try it a bit in Colombia to move to organic farming, and indeed we found that some families were able to live off about 1 hectare of land, 10,000 square meters of land, fairly self-sufficiently, but it requires quite a bit of time and labor intensive. Rather than in El Salvador, the need is to produce something. Even though a small landowner may have, say, a plot of land, and typically a campesino or a peasant would have an acre, well, 7/10 of a hectare, they call a manzana, or up to a manzana and a half of land. Basic survival kind of agriculture, where they plant basically corn and then they put in a bean crop. And that requires about 100 days of labor throughout the year. We calculated in one area of eastern El Salvador that for that 100 days of labor for corn, the return was $50. So one works essentially throughout the entire year, dispersed over 100 days, and the return is $50. So most of the peasants, the campesinos, have to then sell their labor in one way or another. And the place they sell their labor is on these export crop commodities like the coffee, the cotton, the sugar cane, all of which have been introduced into the region more recently. Cotton primarily was introduced into Nicaragua, for example, interestingly enough, at the time of the Korean War. We used to get most of our cotton in the United States from Korea. But an entire area of Nicaragua was set aside by the Somozas for cotton production. And an area that was once very primal rainforest land was turned into cotton. As you may know now, cotton prices have gone way down. Cotton production throughout all of Central America is at least half, if not less, than it has been. This area has virtually been turned into somewhat of a desert. People then that moved from this area of Nicaragua, the peasants, came into this area and began to cut and slash the forest, and now it's been used more as grazing for cattle. So things do compound themselves quite a lot.
Can we go back and answer the question about slash and burn agriculture? You know, it got developed over a few centuries, and
right.
It doesn't erode the soil, it puts nutrients back into it. It makes it a manageable size crop. Now, if we're talking about food first, in other words, if we're talking about feeding the indigenous people,
I
guess I'd have some questions about its viability, its non-viability. I remember seeing a class of agricultural economics at the University of Minnesota here a few years ago. There were some African students heard the professor kind of denigrate slash and burn agriculture.
Yeah.
And they took him on for about an hour, and he just washed out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's. I'm just.
The question is not, and I'm sure you know this. It's not a question of doing it or not doing it. It's the lack of a fallow period, for example, and then the eventual use of that area. It moves from, oftentimes in Central America, Latin America, the peasants have been used as kind of a way of opening up areas, forested areas, cutting them down, kind of settling into those areas, and then they become kind of the wedge for primarily cattle. And so then they're further moved down from there.
That doesn't say anything about slash and burn agriculture. That says, you know,
it begins there. It begins with slash and burn, but then increased use over time, where slash and burn relies upon certainly a fallow period, right?
The end of the period is that we're producing products that aren't going to feed the people. And that's the first instance.
Right.
The next, you talked about going into the forest and cutting them down for grazing. That still begs the question about whether, you know, that is a viable way of doing it.
Uh-huh. Okay, good. Good.
Some of the most recent things that I've read, though, about it, it really does question its viability, even as a method, in that it prevents the soil to produce humus, and it burns off all of the seeds, and so without a fallow period, the land just can't handle year after year after year of burning it off.
But it does lie fallow in the principle of that agriculture for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. That's right. But our point is that there's no longer that luxury of space, particularly, say, in an area like El Salvador. Now, there are other pockets, Nicaragua being one, where that can still be done. There's a rotation, and 4, 5, 6 years are left between the use of a particular area. In El Salvador, there is no land space for that.
Unless you change your priorities altogether.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. I think, and this is something I remember actually, Dave Brown, who's worked with American Freedom for Hunger, has been a stronger advocate for hunger and food related issues, particularly within the church, has been a mentor of many people. And I recall one session I sat in with Dave a number of years ago, really looking at the movement from agriculture-based economies into kind of industrial age, and then now into the communication age. What we may be seeing, and we've played around with this a lot today in terms of preparation of this session, is what we may be seeing is how does something like Latin America, Asia, Africa, make that transition when they're still so bound up with the land. And it's clear that not everybody who is born on the land, particularly if they're 4, 5, 6 children, this may not be simply the case in Latin America and other areas, but North Dakota and South Dakota and Minnesota, can go back and continually work on that land. There have got to be other alternatives, and those alternatives have not emerged within Latin America. Those people who move to the urban settings find unemployment. And then there still is, within certainly many of the Latin American people, a desire to be on the land. That's their identity, just as for Native American people. For them, happiness is involved in being on the land and producing on the land. This is one of the most difficult areas, I think, for any of us who have worked in Latin America. There are very few studies that have adequately dealt with it. EPOCA, the Environmental Project on Central America, is one of the few. Ironically, like many other things, it is not based in Central America. Some of the most important studies, the biggest libraries on Latin America, are found outside. Huh? And really, there needs to be yet an incorporation and a from within of these problems, and then taking this on. One interesting linking of two major problems now in Latin America, the debt problem There's a $350 billion debt within Latin America and the environment. And many of the, a new initiative in the last couple of years has been to swap the debt for doing something about the environment. That is, you forgive the debt or you recant on the debt as long as a government would put aside certain amounts of tracts of land for conservation kinds of projects. This is having some impact now in Costa Rica and in Bolivia and in a few other countries. In other words, there's a need to be very creative in how we look at the sustainability of the environment. Do we have other questions or comments and perhaps some expertise also along this line?
Well, my question is about if the energy in its many forms of the land is being depleted and bled away in general, isn't the landed elite, if you will, going to be as much a loser in the short term, or eventually anyway, as what the campesinos are? And if they are going to be as big of losers, where is their own vision and right. their own sense of responsibility?
Yeah. That's a very good point. And we talk about the ecological boomerang, that this thing really comes back to hit them as well, and it undermines. I think it's wrapped up in just this greed kind of to get what you can get now in the short term, probably put it into other kinds of the capital earnings into other investments which are less dependent upon the land.
And other nations too.
Sure.
And this landed aristocracy in the environment, as well as in human rights, as well as in the conduct of the war, have not demonstrated any sense of responsibility at all. So I, you know, the light bulb isn't going to just come on over their head all of a sudden. And now they just use more and more pesticides, clear more and more land, you know, to keep their production as high as they can for as long as they can without thoughts for the consequences of it.
One, two, and three, yeah.
Has this sort of environmental process led now to noticeable public health problems? I mean, are people really getting sick? I mean, is there epidemics and so forth?
There, you know, potable water is in short supply, not only in the city, like I said, 6% or 10, whatever, 18% of the people in the city and the slums have got access to drinking water. It's even less in the countryside, and so there are a lot of intestinal problems. There are a lot of people who have the people who work on the coffee, cotton, and sugar, especially the cotton plantations, have very severe damage to their skins from the pesticides that they have used. Public health is a big issue.
Isn't that a short enough feedback cycle that you can see the consequences?
But it's not the wealthy landowners that are suffering here. It's the campesinos, the peasant farmers again.
Seriously,
they
don't
count.
Worked in Colombia. I worked about at an elevation of about 2,000 meters, and down below that there was a lot of cotton grown and sugarcane, rice, where they do use a lot of chemical pesticides, which are put on by small airplanes. There, for example, sterility in men was a major problem, poisoning. Toxic poisons. Here's a study by the World Policy Journal on what they call Central America's Other War. 40% of all U.S. pesticide exports went to Central America in the mid-60s and 70s, making the region the world's greatest per capita user of pesticides. Honduras and Nicaragua led the world in per capita illnesses and deaths associated with pesticide poisoning. In Costa Rica, reported pesticide poisonings increased by more than 250% between 78 and 1983 and are now one of the leading causes of illness in Costa Rica. Guatemala infants consume as much as 244 times the U.S. legal allowance of DDT in mother's milk. And adults show more DDT in their body fat than the people of any other country in the world. That's another interesting point that we haven't brought up, that oftentimes if a product is declared unsuitable within the United States or Europe, it often can find a market in some other country. And that is the case with DDT, which remains used in many areas and is a major pesticide for cotton. Yes.
Your last answer answers part of the question. You talked about El Salvador. I wondered if the same thing is happening throughout Central America in the countries that haven't been involved in wars.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think our point is that these are typical of so many countries, and we use El Salvador as a window, and we know it probably the best of the countries that we know, but it is typical. Guatemala, in fact, is engaged in a war, and in fact, there have been a lot of use of defoliants within Guatemala, trying to get at areas where opposition groups are in the mountains of Guatemala. And along the coastal area of Guatemala is probably one of the major areas where pesticide, this is all very flat lowland down along the Pacific coast, southern coast of Guatemala. Again, where the sugar cane, the cotton, and the cattle is. And that's where you see so many environmental problems. The people who work on that land are people from the highlands who come down seasonally to work on those lands. So the Indian population of this area has become affected.
Of the producing land in Central America, three-part question. How much of it is owned, leased, or somehow under control of U.S. or multinational agribusiness concerns? Second question, what are their practices vis-a-vis the environment? And third, can any influence be put on those corporations?
That's also a very good question. Most of agribusiness is dependent primarily on U.S. agriculture, though there's European and now increasingly much more Japanese influence in the region. Most of them, of course, have their national affiliates or subsidiaries, but the products are often produced outside. So how much they control, perhaps they don't control the land so much anymore, but they control the inputs, and then often they control the marketing. For example, there is the case now, Salvadoran coffee, for example, eventually gets in the hands of those who can market it. The kind of pressure and influence, that's a good question. It probably has not been dealt with too much yet. There was a very good video a number of years ago, Guess Who's Coming to Breakfast on the Dominican Republic and the sugar industry there, an effort to look at the use of the land in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. But it doesn't seem to really have impacted those countries at all. They just go on and on and on. Huh? There may be some change, and I think that industry does monitor itself to some extent, but it's going to get also as much as it can out of it while it can.
In El Salvador specifically, that the land is owned by Salvadorans. There are very few international, multinational, like fruit companies or whatever, such as you'd see in Honduras. but it's the inputs and whatever that Phil says that they have their impact on. But it's their Salvadorans, the wealthy landowners are Salvadorans.
But would boycotts of Salvadoran coffee do anything?
Well, there's one in effect right now, by the way, a Salvadoran coffee boycott. There's small efforts.
The way how it works, though, is that they pull, you know, they put this ad in the Boston television program, and what's the big corporation that owns the
Folgers.
And so they pulled off $1 million worth of the advertisements for all the rest of it. Yeah. So the station is left without any income. Mm. Mm.
We skipped a question
yes.
here.
Back in Minnesota, when they had some program to get out from the roads, they had a television program this spring about the rainforests. And one of the rainforests they talked about was the one in Costa Rica that was set aside by the government. Mm-hmm. And they also visited, I guess, the Amazon, which is on the television and the news a lot about the destruction of the rainforests there. Do they have a lot of rainforests in Central America? I understood that Costa Rica had set theirs aside for
a part of it. They have. It's been a recent thing, and it's been a pilot, and it's been successful, and it's been being used as an example for other countries throughout the region. El Salvador's rainforests are gone. I mean, like there are 6% of them left. So that is by the board for El Salvador. But you're right. In Costa Rica, that has begun. I don't know. It's probably 10 years ago that they started doing that. And it's.
Amen. Costa Rica is unique in some ways, and one of the things that they've done well is to preserve some of their environment, and they have not had the large latifundios, the large landowners, as there have been typically in other Central American nations. Yet, I mean, they are facing more and more devastation, too, of some of their environment. Other comments or questions? Again, this is it's an area of extreme difficulty. There's just highlight this that it will not simply have an impact on the Central American people, but as if people now move back into El Salvador, if peace comes about, they'll find it very, very difficult to again work on the land and make it productive unless we can find alternative ways for sustainable agriculture and other kinds of living. As that pressure increases, of course, people migrate, and that's kind of a natural phenomenon anywhere over all history. But where do they have to go? In the 60s, nearly a 500,000 people moved from El Salvador into Honduras, and that became a threat to the Honduran people, who saw that their land was now being occupied by Salvadorans, and the Honduran government declared that all Salvadorans must return immediately to El Salvador, and so over 300,000 people were returned to El Salvador in 1969 and became really the basis of a war, the 1969 war known as the Football War. We will increasingly have those problems. There is not kind of a population equitable balance throughout the region. Nicaragua essentially is underpopulated, whereas El Salvador is very, very overpopulated for the kind of economy that it can sustain. Honduras is not all that populated. At one time, all of this, of course, was one republic. And of course, even before that, nobody was conscious of borders. But now we have political borders with national identities. One of the interesting things that's beginning to happen out of the Central America peace plan is to create a Central America parliament. And perhaps one of the things that they will look at over time is the way that there can be a more of an integrated economy, perhaps with a freer flow of people throughout the region, which may more equitably distribute population over the land. We'd like to close with a reading much more on a hopeful note. Yes?
I have one more question. What is your personal feeling about returning to that land and plugging back into the survival life system that they have?
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis what you're used to, what you might expect, and your very great awareness about what's happening.
For us personally, you mean? Yeah. Now, for the moment, we won't be going back. However, the work of the Lutheran World Federation continues, and many other organizations are there. But we certainly would have a commitment to these issues for some time. I'd like to read from a book that we are... Yes, sure.
I don't know if you have time for one more question, but you addressed possibly some other solutions here in terms of perhaps a migration of population to other Central American countries, whether that's a more of a unified system or whatever. But you were implying earlier that El Salvadorans have been forced onto marginal lands, and that's creating some ecological havoc. Do you think some type of land reform possibly could be a step in the...
With the, actually, the land reform has been a detrimental element in the ecology, because El Salvador does have a land reform. It's in three stages. The first stage is taking moderate-sized lands, cash crop lands. The second stage would have touched the coffee plantations, which were the biggest of the wealthy landowners' plots. And the third is a stage called Land to the Tiller, and that's the one that has gotten a lot of attention and a lot of publicity, and it was good PR. All of this land was being given to the campesinos, but it allowed them not to touch those large cash crop plots from the first two phases, especially the second phase, which was the biggest, wealthiest coffee plantations. But what happened was, when they started focusing on the Land to the Tiller, it again forced the campesinos onto marginal lands, which was all that was available to them. They cleared it, cultivated it, and said, I'm farming this plot, give this plot to me. Well, it was a way for a campesino family, a peasant family, to get a little plot of land, but it further exacerbated the erosion, the soil problems, the water problems, because it forced even more clearing of the hillsides. So, land reform, yes, only if it's, as David mentioned, if it's really a restructuring where you start taking some of these flat lands that are used for cash crops and that belong to the landed aristocracy and redistribute those for corn and beans and whatever. The likelihood of that is not too great.
And so, then, of course, the question is, and this is the way that pretty much the international lending institutions are set up now, is to a production-oriented or economy, to which needs, it's export-led. That is, you have to have something to sell abroad for hard currency, primarily dollars, and that's what sells abroad. El Salvador is not going to sell corn to the United States, or soybeans, or other kinds of beans.
Could this be what you're talking about, the misuse of land and the forcing of peasants out into rural, much more primitive areas? Could this be part of the cause, I'm not just Central America, but even South America, for the production of drugs as a cash crop?
Very good point. Indeed, I think you're right that it is. As I mentioned, a campesino works all year and produces $50 worth of income. Indeed, it's an enormous incentive to be able to produce on that same amount of land marijuana or cocaine. So
our economic policies are backfiring on us in a very cruel way, aren't they?
It's an interesting thing to explore. I don't have the... I've seen that in Colombia. I know it happens in Peru, and you can feel some sympathy for the campesino. Yet they're probably not earning a lot more for themselves. It's the middle people that really drive, and there are other motivations for. for the production of those drugs. But certainly, it's a temptation. Huh? And drugs have been produced up through the Central America region. In fact, Belize now, the small British Honduras, has gone into major production of marijuana. A little hopeful note, it's a little different theme, but it's a question of rebuilding. And since the early 80s, many, many people have fled El Salvador due to the war. And out of a spirit of their own dignity and self-worth and the courage that the Salvadoran people have, in the last now nearly 3 years, 18,000 refugees that have been in United Nations camps in Honduras have returned to their homes in El Salvador, even in the midst of the war. The Lutheran World Federation has been a part of that process all along the way, as of other agencies in all of the Central America major, or the Salvadoran churches, the Lutherans, the Episcopalians, the Baptists, and the Catholic Church. And it's been a way of saying that we want to go back and rebuild. And it's come out of a spirit of a sense of their worth as people of God. And I think it's that kind of sense and identity which may ultimately be able to even tackle some of these environmental problems. When the refugees from Mesa Grande arrived back at the community of Santa Marta, 1,100 refugees, they celebrated their hope and their commitment to each other by giving thanks to God. The reading they chose for the occasion was a beautiful text from the prophet Isaiah, written after the return of the people of Israel from exile. The catechist gathered the people, inviting them to sit on the grassy field. After a short introduction, there was a dialogue between the catechist and the people based on the text from Isaiah. God will always guide you, the catechist began. Yes, yes, an old man responded. It is true, the Lord is the one who called us and guides our return. God has helped us. And you shall be like a watered garden. Yes, brothers and sisters, said a woman, we will build a new society, different from before. It used to be everyone for him or herself. Now we are learning how to work together. If we only trust in God, we can live out a miracle. And if all of us will have enough corn to eat, a new society, a new way of working, and a new way of living. The catechist reminded the people of how important it is to live like this and how such a life requires courage and faith. The dialogue continued. A spring whose waters never run dry. Several people commented, and then the catechist added, we are called to build a new society. As Salvadorans, we must be a light to all nations. We must help break the chains that enslave our brothers and sisters in other countries. Now, I'm talking about the most poor, basic campesino who have absolutely nothing. They are living the same situation as we are. This is the spring which never runs dry, the word of God and the building of a new society in El Salvador. We must be in solidarity with the people of all other nations so that all people may be free. The celebration ended with these words, you will rebuild the ancient ruins and build up the old foundations.